It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. And if you want your garden to thrive in an Iowa summer, you usually need to do a little bit of supplemental watering. Sometimes more than a little bit. This hour, we're going to talk watering strategies. And then, of course, we will be answering your questions. Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester, will join us in about 15 minutes. And with me now, Aaron Steil, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
And Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Richard, last week we were talking about how it's dry in the west, wet in the east. Central Iowa did get a little bit of rain this week, although it was violent, fast rain that came with terrible winds as well. So from your perspective, how are things looking right now?
Well, we were very fortunate in Ames. For the most part, we just got some nice heavy rain, not so much wind, not so much hail. So we got around 1.5 to 2 inches of rain. Much, much appreciated.
Absolutely. But we are still seeing places in western Iowa that are very, very dry, right?
Yes. Boone, Iowa, just 15 miles away, got nothing when we got our 2 inches. So west of Ames, west of Dallas County, it's pretty dry.
All right. Well, let's talk about watering, because that's something that everybody probably needs to at least be thinking about a little bit. Aaron, how do you know when you need to water? What kind of signs should you be looking for?
Well, I mean, hopefully you're catching this before plants start wilting. But of course, a little bit of wilting is one of the big indicators. The best way to really know is to kind of look at the soil. Stick your finger in a little bit. If it is dry to the touch, down to your first or second knuckle on your index finger, you definitely need to water at that point.
All right. And mostly we have kind of a feel for how dry things are or how wet things are where we live.
Yeah. Especially this time of year, you'll start to see your grass kind of gray or brown up a little bit. You know, it loses its vibrant green. You know, that's one of the indications we often see it, especially in the summer when things start to dry out. Plants in general do get a duller color when right before they wilt. And so that, if you can see that, you know, if you get in tune to that, that can be a really great cue. Containers will get really lightweight. If you have stuff in containers, they may blow over more easily or something like that. So those are all also kind of indicators that you can use for knowing to water.
And of course, we know that we're going to have a very, very hot day tomorrow. The hotter it is, the more we need to be thinking about this, right?
Yeah, although it's a little bit of a misnomer that water needs will go up and up and up and up and up as temperatures go up. Because when temperatures get extremely hot, plants do kind of shut down some of their operation. And so they're not using as much water. But when temperatures are really high, we see a lot more evaporation. And so the soil is losing water that way. And so typically we do see more water requirements, but it doesn't mean that just because it's hot that the plants need water. You still have to check the soil.
How much water in general do plants need every week?
It really depends. It's hard to say universally, because soil type, plant type, how exposed the site is, how sunny or shady the site is, will all play a role in how much water plants will use. But in general, we often recommend that we supply, or Mother Nature supplies, about 1 to 1.5 inches of water a week.
All right. And that's kind of hard to measure when we're thinking about our hose or our watering can or the, you know, whatever kind of sprinkler system we have. How do you know how much watering you're doing?
So it depends on how you're applying the water and what you're applying it to. So for things like containers, let's say you have annuals and containers, by this time of year, most of those containers are probably going to need to be watered once a day, hanging baskets at least once a day, because the plants are big enough and the soil volume is small enough that you can pretty much count on watering them most days. In terms of garden areas, you kind of have to get a feel and kind of determine how you're watering. So if you're overhead watering, which isn't ideal, but sometimes, especially in certain situations, you end up overhead watering, you can just set up a rain gauge, run that, and then you only have to do that once because then you have a good idea of how long you have to run your sprinkler to get a certain amount of water. And the same can be true in terms of timing for things like soaker hoses or drip irrigation. Instead of using a rain gauge, though, you're going to, the first time you turn that stuff on, you're going to let it run, say, for 30 minutes, and then kind of dig down a little bit. And if the top several inches of soil, especially if the top 2 inches of soil, are nice and damp, then you know 30 minutes is the time you can run that, and you'll get a good soaking that way. If it's not quite there, you can go a little bit longer. And once you've kind of determined that for that area, you can use that for the rest of the season whenever you need to be watering. I know I need to turn my soaker hose on for 30 minutes, and then that applies the right amount of water.
All right, and probably set a timer because I can't keep track of 30
minutes. Oh, yes. Yes, set a timer, especially for things like soaker hoses or drip systems because you don't see them operating. And thankfully, all of us have, or nearly all of us, have something in our pocket that makes it really easy to set a timer on. I have an alarm on my phone that says turn off sprinkler, and it is reused every time I turn on water so that I don't forget to turn it off. There are also some water timers, so much like a lamp in your living room, you might put a timer on to come on every day or turn off at a certain time. You can buy a very similar thing for your hose. And so you can do things like turn on your hose before you leave for work in the morning and have the timer turn it off, or give yourself a backup so that you don't accidentally leave something running all day or all night.
All right. And you've already mentioned a number of the different ways that we can water. And of course, water is better than no water, but there are better ways to water. So give me kind of a rundown of first, let's start with your preferred. If you had your druthers, how would you water the garden?
It would be with soaker hoses or drip irrigation. So soaker hoses are typically easier for homeowners to set up and easier for homeowners to use. They can be maybe a little bit more flexible too, depending on the situation, but they both run with the same kind of idea, which is applying water directly at the base of the plant. And you have very little waste then to evaporation. And the other great benefit to this type of watering is that you don't wet the foliage. And so plants that are particularly sensitive to disease issues, in particular those that are in our vegetable garden, like tomatoes, we don't want to do a lot of overhead watering because it can promote a lot of foliar diseases. So using a soaker hose or drip irrigation system is great for that. The downside to those systems, though, is that they take time to set up and they take a little bit of time to get used to. But once you have them set up, they're good to go for pretty much the rest of the season.
All right. So if you can't have the ideal situation, let's walk it down. What are some of the other techniques?
Yeah. Some of the other, the two other big ones would be using a sprinkler, an overhead sprinkler. And the style you use, whether it's kind of the ones that kind of ratchet around or the ones that fan back and forth, is really kind of personal preference based on the area that you're trying to water, the size of it, and those kinds of things. The thing to keep in mind with those is that they do get foliage wet. So because of that, it's beneficial to run those first thing in the day, usually sometime before 9 a.m., so that the rest of the day can help dry off that foliage and help reduce potential disease issues. If you run them at night, then that foliage stays wet all night, which can be a little problematic. And if you run them in the middle of the day, because they're spraying water around, you get a lot of evaporation, which even if, it's kind of wasteful, but it also costs you more money then too, because you're paying for that water, whether it evaporates or gets to the plant. So they're certainly very convenient, which is why a lot of people use them. And then if you can't do that, then you can do hand watering. And a lot of times our containers, sometimes our vegetable gardens, hand watering is a great option. It's very flexible. It's very precise. Make sure you're using a water wand or a water breaker, not a nozzle. Those are great for washing your cars, but they're not great for watering plants. So having that good equipment makes it. Yeah, it washes a lot of soil away. It can, and it doesn't deliver as much water as you might think it does. But a nice breaker, especially if it's got a nice long handle so you're not bending over, allows you to apply that soil right at the base of the plant without getting foliage wet, and do a really good job of providing that water. But it does take more time. It's more labor intensive. You're there watering. You can't let it kind of set it and do something else.
Right. Although that can be very meditative. I think a lot of people
enjoy that. I don't mind it. I don't mind it. I try to keep it to a minimum, but you know, a half hour of enjoying my garden and watering that stuff is a nice way to spend first thing in the morning.
And you mentioned the base of the plant. When you water your plants, you want to make sure that you're really getting the whole root system right, not just right at the base of the plant. How do you tell that you're doing that?
Well, for the most part, kind of the area the plant covers in terms of the soil represents a good chunk of their root system, depending on how the plant grows. And so kind of wetting the area directly at the base of the plant, and depending on the size of the plant, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 inches for smaller plants to a couple of feet out for larger, maybe trees or shrubs, is beneficial. Because we want to make sure that we're promoting root development and getting water to those roots that aren't just right at the very base of the plant. This is particularly true for newly planted plants, perennials, trees, and shrubs that have been in your garden for less than a year or for maybe 2 or 3 years. They're still getting established, and many of their roots are concentrated in that original root ball. And in almost all situations, that original root ball from the container will dry out before the surrounding soil. And so you kind of have to balance that, especially for really newly planted things, like things that maybe were planted this spring. You'll want to water really well that original root ball, but then also make sure that you're wetting the surrounding soil so that those roots are encouraged to move out and into that soil to get well established.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Mark Vitosh is also here with us today. He is a DNR Forester. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And Mark, we haven't talked in a long time. You're in eastern Iowa, so you're on the wetter side of the state. How are things looking for trees?
Well, just like Richard said, it kind of depends where you are. I have a gauge at my place, and I have a landowner that lives about 10 miles away from me. And last week, he got 5 inches, and I got a half inch. So it really varies, and unlike Richard, we got quite a bit of wind in the Cedar Rapids area and north up to Central City and Wabeek. So we had some isolated areas where we sustained some pretty significant tree damage. So people are kind of dealing with pruning, cleaning up, and those kinds of things related to the storm. So the growth-wise, it really varies, but in some areas, we've got some pretty good consistent moisture.
All right. Well, we have a lot of people with a lot of questions that they want to ask this hour, so let's dive right in. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start with a question for you, Mark. This is from Jenny. She says, I have a large mature oak tree, 100 years old perhaps, at the base of its trunk. It has very black substance that looks like oil. It shows on the dirt or mulch, not on the tree trunk itself. Is there a need to worry about this? I've heard there's a disease going around that affects oak trees. This is a bigger question. If so, are Iowa trees at risk? But let's start with that black substance first. What do you think?
Well, there's a couple possibilities. One that comes up first that can be common on a number of trees if they have a wound at the base or a wound from an old stub is a condition called slime flux or wet wood. which is actually caused by a bacteria. And that bacteria is inside the plant and oozes out of areas such as wounds and then stains that area. That stain can change a lot of different colors. It can be dark. It often attracts bees, flies, and other things. The other possibility is that dark area could be an indication of some type of boar or something that's entering that area. What I would suggest for Jenny, and I'm sure Richard will mention it multiple times, but that she Google the Iowa State University Disease Plant Diagnostic Clinic and send them a picture and let them look to see if they can confirm that it's potentially wetwood or some other cause.
All right.
And the final answer is there's a lot of issues with trees. And the thing that people need to understand, each individual tree problem is often an individual tree problem. So just because you might see something doesn't mean that we're seeing it everywhere, or it could be specific to that site. So you really need to investigate what's going on.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Carol is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I am always trying to be a conserving person. So since we wash our hands so often, I have been collecting my hand washing water, and it has a little bit of liquid soap in it, and I've been putting it on all of my plants. Is that okay?
All right, Aaron, what do you think?
It shouldn't cause a lot of problems unless you're concentrating it, say, in one container plant or something like that. But if you're kind of spreading it around and using it in various areas of your garden or yard, it shouldn't cause a lot of issues.
Okay. And is there a point at which you should be concerned if you think, oh, this looks really soapy?
I probably wouldn't be that concerned especially if I were putting it in soil instead of, say, a container. There is so much buffering action in the soil, and the soil volume is so large, it would take an extensive amount to really start to cause some kind of damage.
All right. Carol, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number for you to call with your questions. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. From Emily in Des Moines, I have a plum tree in my front yard that typically produces a great deal of fruit. This year, about one third of the branches have no leaves or any signs of growth. The rest of the tree does have fruit. Is there something wrong with the tree? Should I remove the limbs that don't have growth? Richard, what do you think?
It definitely has a problem. I'm not sure of the cause. I would prune out the dead limbs. And if it has a lot of fruit, maybe do some thinning. So those branches that are still alive that are bearing don't overproduce, and maybe some of the branches might break if they're too heavy.
All right. Here's a question from Marlene. I last fertilized my roses on June 18th. Should I do it again this summer? Aaron?
You could probably, if you did it in the next couple of days or in the next week or so, wouldn't have much issue. We usually try to back off on fertilizing things like roses as we get later into the season, because we don't want to be pushing a lot of growth going into winter, but we're still far enough away from winter. One more round would probably be helpful for the plants.
All right, but don't dilly-dally.
Roses in particular.
No procrastination.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, here's a question for you, Mark, from Chris. I transplanted a 12-inch volunteer white pine this spring. It has 3 equal leaders. When should I pick a central leader and prune the others?
Today.
Okay.
I would say he can do it at any time. I mean, what he probably wants to do is let them go ahead and grow, and then any time the next couple weeks, he can basically pick that. Or if he wants, he can wait till winter, to let that energy go to roots first, and then this winter, pick the best one and go from there. Because if he leaves those, the potential for poor structure and stuff can really go. So if he wants to give it a little more energy, I would actually wait, and then this winter pick the best one and then clip the other two off.
All right. Here is a question from Rebecca in Moline. I staked my indeterminate tomato plant, and it's tall and lanky, 5 feet tall, but healthy. Should I prune it at the top so it becomes more bushy? Would I get more fruit if I do? It has a few flowers at the very top. I hate to sacrifice the flowers, but I will if you think it's necessary to prune. She also wants to add that the plant is in a container. Richard?
I think I would just let it droop over if necessary. And then maybe around September 1st, they can prune off the top.
All right. And another email question, then we'll get back to the phones. From Donald in Solon, I've been battling purslane all summer in my garden. Any tips on keeping this under control? Aaron?
I have too. Apart from hand pulling, purslane actually is pretty satisfying to hand pull because it often all originates from one kind of little spot. So when you pull a plant up, it pulls out a lot more green material than you think it might. It's a little hard to get those fine roots. They very easily break off at the base. But typically, I approach it with hand pulling. If you don't want to do that, you can spot spray with a non-selective herbicide, and that will do it too.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to join our conversation today with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tom is on the line next in Dubuque. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Yes. Well, I planted a flowering Loaiza crabapple last year, and I chose that just because I read that it was fairly disease resistant. But I noticed that the leaves of summer are developing some brown spots, small circular spots, and I just wanted to see if there's something that I should be doing to it to prevent a small problem from turning into a bigger one.
I'll go ahead and take that, Charity. Tom, there can be a variety of the most common on crab apples is apple scab, and even if they say that they're tolerant or resistant, if the weather conditions are correctly, you can or good enough, you can see that disease still to some point. But usually with that, it'll be kind of a black, skimmy color to the top of the leaves, and then they'll turn yellow. Mm-hmm. But there are some other common leaf spots, and in general, with the leaf spots, unless they're coalescing, generally they won't cause a lot of damage. They'll just be there. And as we mentioned earlier, and Richard, you can give the email. I would suggest that you email some pictures to the Plant Diagnostic Clinic in Ames. They're heavily loaded, so give them some time. But just to identify what it is, because the issue with leaf disease is once they're there, there's nothing you can do. But you can identify it, and if it is something, sometimes raking up the leaves in the fall to reduce inoculum the next year are things you can do. So at least getting it identified, then you know what to do next year if it shows up again, if it's pathogenic.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
All right, and Richard, you want to give that email address?
Sure. It's PIDC at IASTATE.edu. And it could be apple scab, could be cedar apple rust, but usually those things are more cosmetic that the plants typically survive quite well. And at this point, it's way too late to do anything. So,
all right. Let's go now to Barbara on the line in Brooklyn. Hi, Barbara.
Well, hello there.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a mature honeysuckle that is growing on an arbor, and lately the leaves have turned kind of powdery spots, and some are starting to turn yellow and fall off. I'm thinking that this was powdery mildew. I did douse it a couple of times with insecticidal soap, but it does not appear to be getting better.
Yeah, it definitely could be powdery mildew. That's fairly common on some of the vining-type honeysuckles.
Mm-hmm.
Fungicides would work, but soapy water doesn't work. Soapy water controls certain insects like aphids and spider mites, but it has no effect on a fungus. There are fungicides that can be used, but typically you need to use them at the very first sign of symptoms, that they prevent the problem much better than they cure the problem.
So I can find the fungicide at garden store or?
Yeah, typically most garden centers will have some type of multi-purpose fungicide, and the active ingredient in most of those compounds is chlorothalonil. Don't ask me to spell it.
you'll know it when you see it. All right, Barbara, thanks so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. John is up next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a big chunk of peonies growing alongside my garage, and I'd like to move them so they're encroaching on the neighbor's yard. I'd like to move them.
All right. So
what do you suggest?
When and how do you move the peonies? Aaron?
Actually, kind of early summer, late fall is a great time to move peony. You can basically dig up the clump, and if you need to, you can trim back some of the foliage so that it stands up well. The big thing to keep in mind is that those big, coarse, fleshy roots need to be just a few inches below the soil surface and with the mulch on top. So you don't want to put them too deep. So pay attention to where they're sitting at in the soil before you move it, and make sure they get back into that same depth in their new location. That would be a great time if you wanted to divide. You could do that at that time. And so you can share them and just make sure that wherever you're moving them to is in the full sun, because they do need full sun to do well.
All right. And Aaron, when you say late fall, give us a ballpark. Are we waiting until a frost
late summer. Sorry, late summer, early fall. So August into the first part of September.
Okay. Great. John, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can join us. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Joe. She says, is it okay to fertilize planters when it's really hot? Richard?
Yes. Typically by midsummer, if you have a potting soil, many of these potting soils have some fertilizer in them already. But by midsummer, most of the plants have used it up. And so beginning about mid-July or so, I would start fertilizing. And what I would do, I would simply add a little bit of a water-soluble fertilizer to my water. And when I water the plant, I would do that maybe every 2 weeks or so.
All right. And this one's for you, Mark, from Bob in Ames. Are you seeing more herbicide damage on trees out in the countryside this year? We've talked about oak tatters in the past and herbicide damage. What does this year look like?
Well, as we always say in this talk, the only way to truly know that you have herbicide damage on a plant or tree is to get it tested. But with that said, some of the symptoms that we see related to some of the growth regulator herbicides are cupping and curling, and I can report that we are seeing quite a bit of that on a lot of different plants out on the countryside. I will tell you, though, with heat, sometimes that can also cause cupping and curling or aphids or mite damage, so people need to look. But a lot of times those leaves or needles will be very distorted. And I've been getting reports from all over the state. People are seeing tatters. They are seeing cupping and curling. So there seems to be some potential damage out there.
All right. And as we head into the break now, this is for you, Aaron. I think from Elle, she says, don't forget about purslane. You can eat it. Research it if you want to, but it's healthy to eat and it's tasty. So, you know, if you're enjoying the pulling, you can also add some food prep to that.
You can. Just make sure that you know well what's been applied, because especially in a lawn setting, many of the chemicals that we may put on a lawn would not be stuff I would want around my food plants.
All right. And let's see if we can squeeze this one in from Jean. I didn't get the strawberries cut back after producing their crop this year. Should I do it now? Is there anything else I should do for the strawberry bed this year? Richard?
You typically need to mow off the foliage within 1 week of the last harvest. And if you haven't done that, it's too late. If they're in a row, though, you can still go out with like a tiller or a shovel and narrow that row down to a 12-inch wide strip.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Mark in Marion. My neighbors have brown rings in their sod. They're about 18 inches in diameter. They have continued to exist from 1 year to the next, with several more developing this year. They're starting to develop in my yard now, too. What causes these and how can we treat them? Richard?
Well, that could be a number of different things. It could be a fairy ring, where they're basically circles in the yard. And within the circle, the grass is green, but the circle itself is brown, and it may be just a few inches wide. And over years, it may reappear year after year, and over time, the actual circle gets bigger and bigger. There's really nothing you can do about that. It's caused by a fungus. It's in the soil. So there's really nothing you can do about that. Usually, it's not terribly destructive. The spotting could also be due to some type of turf-type disease, and so they may want to take some photos and send the photos to the plant diagnostic clinic. I would take maybe one or two photos of the lawn as a whole in that area, and then maybe one or two close-ups of the circles.
All right, and now let's get back to the phones. Linda is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay. I believe what I have growing in my driveway is crown vetch. Years ago, along Interstate 80, it was all over in the ditches and stuff, I think. And I have a very steep alley hillside that I'm wondering if I could transplant the crown vetch plants that I have onto this alley, or is that something the state of Iowa doesn't want me to do?
All right, Aaron, do you want to try that one?
Well, crown vetch is a kind of plant that once you've established it in a spot, it's probably going to be there for a very long time. And if you ever decide that you don't like it or you want to get rid of it, it will be very difficult. And so you have to kind of be careful about where you're putting it, because it can be quite an aggressive spreader, which actually would make it a very good candidate for covering a hillside, for example.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why you sometimes see it along roads and ditches and some of those other things. But it kind of personally, I probably wouldn't, because the plant is so aggressive and so difficult to get rid of. If it is something that I don't want around anymore, but in terms of erosion control and some things like that, it is an option.
All right.
Charity, I would also offer native prairie plants, flowering and native grasses would be a great roadside habitat also.
All right, so that might be a better alternative that would not carry with it the same problems of crown vetch.
It would help the pollinators greatly.
All right. Linda, thanks a lot for your call. Karen is on the line next from Carlisle. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got several questions here. I'll try not to take too much time. But my first question is, I've got a lot of ground squirrels in my yard, which I dearly love. But they do tend to get into my flower and plant containers and do some digging. Is there any humane way I can discourage them from doing that?
Well, Richard, you want to tackle that first? Any thoughts?
I'm not sure that you really can unless you put something on the surface that would prevent them from doing so.
All right, so maybe a hardware cloth screen, something
that's
open, you can water through it, but they can't dig through it.
That's kind of what I thought. And then my next question is, we have a planting by our deck that has grown into a tree. It's called Lentigo viburnum, and it's starting to get a lot of dead in it, and I wondered what a good replacement would be. It's a small area, it's by our deck, and it's a shaded area.
Aaron?
The first thing that comes to my mind is actually a different viburnum, arrowwood viburnum, because it would tolerate light shade fairly well. It has a slightly different, it's more suckering than the viburnum you have now, but it has nice fall color, has pretty white flowers, and has nice berries for wildlife.
Okay, and what was the name of that again, please?
Arrowwood viburnum.
Arrowwood?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. And my last question, and I don't know the correct terminology for these, but we call them snowball bushes. They get quite large, and they have huge white flowers on them. We have four of them in a row planted by a fence. The problem with them is when they get so big, they just spread out all over. We'd like something a little smaller than that, but perhaps kind of that same look. Do you have a recommendation for that?
Richard?
I'm assuming these are probably hydrangeas. That's my guess.
Yeah, yes, and they get very large.
There are a lot of new cultivars, that are shorter in stature and have stronger stems or branches. So I would go to a local garden center and see if you can find something, but there's a lot of new varieties that are shorter and much sturdier.
All right, Karen, thanks so much for your call. And let's go back to a couple of email questions here. This one's from Noah. I planted an oak tree about 7 years ago from an acorn. It's now about 12 feet tall and 1 to 2 inches in diameter at the base of the trunk. Unfortunately, it is in the wrong part of the yard. Is it too late for me to dig it up and transplant it to another area?
How tall did you say it was,
Karen? It is about 12 feet tall.
It's getting too big to hand plant, but if he really wants to transplant it and has room to get to it, he could talk to a local person or someone in the area that has a much larger tree spade and a good-sized, either a 50 or even an 80 tree spade could take a tree that size. And he would be looking either at a fall transplant or a spring transplant. So if he can find a local landscape company or nursery that has a larger tree spade, it still is an option. It's harder with oak trees, but it's still an option.
All right, and a little more expensive than planting an acorn at
yes,
that
ma'am.
Point.
But if it's a really good quality tree, it's doable.
All right. Here's a question from Jean near Earlham. Oh, actually, I already asked that question. Sorry. From Lauren, I have a clematis that prefers light shade and is in the appropriate spot growing on a metal trellis. It began to turn brown several weeks ago and appears to be dead. It has been watered and roots are relatively shaded. Do you think it will come back next year? Aaron?
It very well could. There's a fairly common disease that hits clematis. Called clematis wilt, and often the plant will come back from the base after that happens, and so hopefully as long as you do a good removal, make sure you get rid of all that dead material soon so that there isn't that stuff in the surrounding soil, you can hopefully you'll see some new growth.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Andrew's on the line in Pottawatomie County. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have a rather large wild blackberry patch that produced really well this year, and I'm wondering what I need to do to, A, keep that patch going, and, B, make it a little more accessible to the berries in the middle.
All right, and do you mean black raspberries, Andrew?
It's wild. I mean, they just propped up, and we burnt the grass out a couple of times over the last, say, 5 or 6 years, and they're just, I mean, there's nothing that was planted, so I assume they're just blackberries.
Okay, but they're little and round, right?
Not so much round as elongated, sort okay. of an oval shape, and they're about the size of your thumb, the end of your thumb.
All right, those sound like blackberries, Richard.
Well, what I would probably do is go out there. The canes themselves only live 2 years, and they typically produce the second year. So once they're done bearing, they're going to die. And so I would go out there and remove all the dead sticks or the dead canes. Another thing you could do would be to maybe very carefully kind of mark off a row and then go out there and somehow destroy those plants within that row, which gives you a walkway where you can get in there and do your harvesting and things like that.
And do you have a recommendation for how to destroy those plants in the row?
You could use a shovel. You could use a tiller, where you would simply cut them back to the ground and then dig them up or till them up.
Andrew, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Tim in Indianola. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
So my question is, I have my neighbor was burning a stump, and the fire got way too hot, and the stump was next to the property line where I have two white pines that are growing. And although the bark on the white pines is not scorched, all of the needles on the sides facing that fire that he had on the stump have turned brown and dropped off. And I'm just wondering if those white pines have come back. One has about an 11-inch trunk, 11-inch diameter trunk, and the other one's about 8 inches.
Mark?
So the thing to keep doing, Tim, is to scrape. I mean, there's a good chance with that much heat and stuff, it will kill those. But if you scrape the bark of the branches and it's still green and then there's still buds intact that appear green, I would wait and give that tree a chance or give those branches a chance. The thing to understand about white pine is they actually only hold 1 year's needles into the next year. So this fall, they would drop all the inner needles from last year, basically. So they would just have this year's. So they may not have any needles, but if that bud and those buds are still intact and they're green, it will have a chance to leaf out next year. They'll look thin, but they'll still have a chance. So as long as those branches are green and there's buds, there's a chance. But with, you know, a lot of heat, I've seen a lot of those killed. But if they're still green, there is a chance.
Okay, thank you.
You're
all right. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Tim. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Kirk is up next in Ames. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Two things. I've got some hydrangea bushes that used to have beautiful flowers, but they haven't had any for the last few years. And I was wondering if there's any way to bring those back. And also orchids. My wife likes orchids, but is there a way to get those to rebloom after they've lost the flowers?
As far as the hydrangeas, do they have pink or blue flowers or white?
White, and I was putting some kind of ammonia or something to make them blue.
Okay. So you have a big leaf hydrangea, and they're much more finicky as far as blooming. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. What I would do as far as pruning them is wait until they leaf out in the spring. Let them leaf out fully. And then prune out any dead wood. These big leaf hydrangeas
okay.
bloom on new wood and also old wood. So just prune out the dead wood that doesn't leaf out in the spring.
Okay. Is there any kind of fertilizer or anything I should add?
You can fertilize them a little bit in the spring. Just use like an all-purpose garden fertilizer, like a 10-10-10. And the other thing is with the big
okay.
leaf hydrangeas, if it gets dry, those big leaves wilt very quickly, so make sure they're well watered during dry stretches.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Kirk. Good luck with that. 866-780-9100 is the number, although we're nearly out of time. Let's do some email questions here. This one's from Ellie. For you, Mark, the beetles have decimated the leaves on my river birch tree. Is the tree damaged? I assume she means Japanese beetles.
I'm assuming you are correct. You know, we always talk about this, and they can usually withstand a couple years of that kind of damage and then continue to come back. But if it happens year after year after year, it can be pretty damaging, and sometimes we may get decline or other issues attacking that tree. So what I would tell her is during the really, if she is in a location that's really dry and having issues there, that late summer, early fall, she makes sure that she gets a good soaking to those trees to help them along a little bit. And what will happen a lot of times, even with that heavy damage, they will try to re-leaf some before the end of the year. So have her hang in there. I would not fertilize. The only thing I would do is supplemental water to give them a chance.
All right, we've got another tree question here. This one's from Susan. I have some small trees from the state nursery that I, quote, healed in 3 years ago, and I finally have the time to transplant them. When is the best time to transplant them, and any other tips?
I would actually have Susan wait till next spring. That when they're dormant is the best time, and depending, especially if they're conifers, spring is going to be the best. If there are some oaks and stuff mixed in, she could do it late fall after all the leaves fall off, but you don't gain that much. So the big thing is going to be 3 years, they're probably good size, so she's going to want to probably bare root them in the spring when they're still dormant and get as much of that root system as possible. If the roots are really big, she can do some light pruning to make them more uniform for transplanting, but she'll want to keep the roots moist before she gets them in to whatever new location and put them in a spot where she doesn't have to transplant them again. Make sure they have room to grow and give them water the first 2 years.
All right.
Control the weeds.
Once is enough. Aaron Marcia says, I have lots of hollyhock seedlings, small to around 1 foot high. When and how can I transplant those?
Oh, usually you would want to do that kind of early in the season. This is going to be a really stressful time of year to try to do it.
All right. We are out of time. Thank you all so much for being here. Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
And Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. Thank you, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.